Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jewish settlers clashed with Israeli security forces in the Gaza Strip today, the first official day of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan for Israeli disengagement from Gaza, Israeli pullout. 21 settlements are to be evacuated this week. Israeli troops are now distributing notices giving remaining settlers 48 hours to leave their homes. After that, evacuation will be by force if necessary. The pullout has become a battleground over Israel's understanding of itself, its past, its future, and its relationship with the Palestinians. Thousands have protested the pullout plan for months. Many pledged to continue defying Sharon's decision to withdraw. But the majority of Israelis support the pullout and say it's the only way to preserve a Jewish state and a democratic one. We will be talking in coming days with Palestinians about their view of the withdrawal and the way ahead. But today we focus on the pullout and Israel's sense of itself, the Israeli identity. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What does this disengagement mean to you? Is this the loss of a dream for Israel or a step toward reality, toward peace? We begin in Gaza with Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What can you tell us about the scene there in Israel, in Gaza today, Steve?
Well, it's the first day that it became legal for Israeli civilians to be in Gaza. This is a kind of friendly period where the police are trying to distribute notices to various settlers, warning them that as of Wednesday morning, that is their last chance to be peacefully or quietly. You've had a lot of very emotional scenes here. Many people have already left, and many more will leave. But as of Wednesday morning, all this happy, friendly remonstration with one another will change, and it will become a very much of a military operation. And certainly over the next week or more, I have no doubt that all the settlements of Gaza will be pulled out.
Steve, we read that in Israel on Monday morning, in Gaza, a big convoy of Israeli army vehicles coming in, 50 vehicles, jeeps, ambulances, buses carrying police officers and soldiers. Is the Israeli army already very much in evidence in the settlements?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they've been around, but they moved in large numbers early this morning. They have always been here to protect the settlements from Palestinian militants who live very close by. But a lot more are here. As many as 55,000 are involved in the whole operation, and not all of them in Gaza. And they're everywhere, but it's many of them are kind of, it's still a kind of brotherly business for the moment. Even the most upset settlers or most devout settlers swear they love the army and that they bear no real grudge. They're a little less friendly toward the police. But this is one of these very strange things, which in some ways is very Israeli, which there is in the end a kind of commingling and a sense of a small nation that can't afford too deep a rift for too long. This is going to be very painful, and there are already a number of insults flying back and forth. But, as bad as Wednesday may be, I think these 2 days of reflection will probably make it easier to take than it would have been otherwise.
We see reports that about half of the nearly 9,000 settlers in Gaza have withdrawn, that maybe 5,000 ultranationalists have joined the balance. Is the Israeli army expecting physical resistance on Wednesday? Is it going to be mayhem?
First of all, I don't think half of the settlers have left, by the way. I think more will leave tomorrow. Many of them have packed up. And the number of infiltrators, you know, some of them are very young, you know, 17, 18-year-old kids. It's kind of their religious and political Woodstock. Most of them are not toughies. I think there'll be a lot of passive resistance, a lot of people who have forced the army and the police to carry them out. But even the most militant settlement, Kfar Daron, has handed over its weapons. And I don't, you know, there may be terrible incidents. There may be someone bent on trying to stop something or hurting people. But in general, I think they are expecting all kinds of contingencies, including attacks from the Palestinian side of Gaza. But they do not expect widespread use of physical force against them. And, you know, that they're prepared for it.
We read of plans to demolish about 1,500 homes in settlement areas in Gaza. The Palestinians say that's fine. They don't need single-family homes. They need big apartment blocks for their big population anyway. What is expected about when Palestinian security forces and others may first begin to enter these settlement territories?
Well, the Palestinians side are saying, you know, that they hope in October to have bus tours of what's left of these settlements. They're coordinating on the ground, which is good, division commanders. I mean, the Israelis know where the Palestinians are deployed and vice versa. You know, the timing remains to be seen. The army hopes to have all this done by September 4th. Some would have it done sooner. You know, things happen. There are always surprises. So it's very hard to predict timing.
But as of today, your newspaper reporting a big railroad-style barrier lowered across the road into Gaza saying stop entry into the Gaza Strip and presence there is forbidden by law. Things are changing. Stephen Erlanger in Gaza, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Gaza. Joining me now in the studio is Shai Feldman, director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. He is former head of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University. Shai Feldman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
A big moment in Israeli history. How would you describe the import of what's going on there this week in Gaza?
Well, I think it's not, first of all, we have to remember this is not just Gaza. This disengagement plan also has a component in the northern part of the West Bank, which is very, very important in terms of a symbol of what is possible ahead.
Signaling that the West Bank is not immune from this.
Exactly. So first of all, we have to remember that although this is popularly called the Gaza Plan, this goes beyond Gaza. In my view, the significance of this is that it's another step in a way in determining the primary goal of Israel, another step in the sense that as of the early 30s, there were essentially two competing dreams of the Zionist movement. One is to establish a Jewish state in the greater land of Israel, which meant originally it actually meant not only the Israel, what is today Israel and the West Bank, but also what is the East Bank, what is Jordan, what is Transjordan.
There was talk of both sides of the Jordan River.
Exactly. And that dream has gradually contracted to the greater land of Israel, meaning between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. That was one school. And the second school, as of the early 30s, sought to create a Jewish and democratic state. And knowing that there are Arab there is an Arab population, it was clear that that can only be established by partitioning the land. And this process of determining that Israel will go for partitioning, will go for a Jewish and democratic state, well, there were, again, phases in this as of the acceptance of the Peel Commission report in 1936 and the acceptance of partition in 1947. And essentially, Israel between 1947 and 1967 was the partitioned land. The results of the 1967 war essentially swung in favor of those who dreamt about the greater land of Israel. But as of Oslo, as of the Oslo Accords, again, Israel is solidifying itself around the effort to restore itself as a Jewish and democratic state, and that means towards partition. And so, you know, Oslo was one step. In a sense, the White River Accords signed by Prime Minister Netanyahu in 1998 was another important step. It was because it was the first Israeli prime minister who belonged to the camp that advocated the greater land of Israel that had to accept that that's not possible anymore. And now the disengagement plan is another step towards essentially the repartitioning of Israel.
But the debate is not over Benjamin Netanyahu resigning only this last week in protest over this pullout. Clearly a lot of emotion still running toward that old Zionist dream that you described, the greater Israel dream. Is that now dead? Will Israelis who have thrown their support in that direction be coaxed into a mainstream that's got a different mission?
Well, the debate is not over, but I would say that right now the debate is characterized by the following. The numbers favor those who favor partition. Every public opinion poll, depending on question wording, will tell you that between 65% to 75% of the population supports disengagement because it understands what it's about. The problem is that the minority is much more energized, committed, organized, and so on and so forth, whereas the majority is relatively passive. So there is the debate still goes on, and it would appear to be more balanced than it actually is because of this asymmetry in commitment between those who support repartition and those who are against this, including against the disengagement. But once again, you also have to distinguish between the issue of within the opposition. There is also a split between those who are opposed to this in principle because they still believe in the dream of the greater land of Israel. That seems to be a smaller and smaller numbers. And those who say, yes, okay, we have to go for partition, but we should not go for this unilaterally, not in a situation in which the other side doesn't commit itself to anything. And that seems to be at least Netanyahu's position.
Shai Feldman with Brandeis University, thanks for being with us. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking this hour about the Gaza pullout and Israel's identity as the settlers begin to leave. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Gaza pullout this hour and the soul of Israel very much on the line, maybe very much shifting as Israeli soldiers move into Gaza in greater numbers than perhaps have been seen there since 1967 and Israeli settlers prepare to move out or to resist. You can join the conversation this morning. Have you watched the settlers packing up, digging in? What's your response? Hope, sorrow, joy, fear? And is this a step toward peace, toward the two-state solution? Is this the end of Greater Israel, of the settlers' dream of Jews from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Shai Feldman. He's director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. And right now, from the Israeli settlement of Gush Katif in Gaza, we're joined by Benny Elon, a member of Israel's Knesset, former tourism minister in Ariel Sharon's government. His new book is God's Covenant with Israel, Establishing Biblical Boundaries in Today's World. Benny Elon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So what's your view of what's going on there, Benny Elon? Are you going to peacefully depart Gaza? Are you going to resist?
Yeah, of course. Resistance has to be. After all, we cannot show our enemies that they are the natives that belong to here, and we, as they said, strangers that don't belong, and we are the wandering Jews that are here only on temporary basis. If they will whet their appetite by seeing how Ariel Sharon, the Prime Minister, uprooting Jews by force and running away under fire because there is a fire still here, and having this situation of surrendering under fire, this just will be the beginning of their appetite to go ahead, not only to Judea and Samaria, to see all of the state of Israel as a temporary thing, as they used to think. And we, the believers, the Jews that believe that we are the children of Israel that came back to the land of Israel for good, we cannot let them this joy.
Benny Alon, let me ask you, your new book is called God's Covenant with Israel, and you're talking there about boundaries and territory. Do you believe that with this move, with the pullout from Gaza that is underway, though it may yet be resisted, that the dream of a greater Israel is history? Is it finished?
No, absolutely not. I think that my Jewish prime minister is doing a great mistake, a big... Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
A great mistake, a big, big crime, I can say, using the uniform of our soldiers instead of against the external enemy, against brothers and father against son and son against father, and uprooting by force Jews. All of those things are very, very bad. But we should bring him down very, very soon and democratically, only democratically. We are not going to destroy our democratic state. We are going to have elections soon, and the results will speak. I have no doubts about it.
But, Mr. Alon, let me ask you, you know many critics of the Greater Israel Dream say Israel will never have peace if it seeks more territory in Gaza and the West Bank. Can you have both that dream and peace with the Palestinians? Could you ever have it?
Listen, I don't know even one man, including Sharon himself, that speaks about peace. They don't speak here about peace. They don't. It's not the case of Menachem Begin that signed peace treaty with the largest Arab nation, Egypt, and then gave up a few settlements by big majority in the Knesset. This is a case of unilateral plan under fire. We didn't sign no treaty. There is nothing in exchange. Even the graves we have to open and to take the bones of the soldiers and the people that were buried here with us, because people are afraid that the Palestinians, Muslims, fundamentalists will play football with the bones. This is not peace. No one in Israel thinks that this is something that's going to be peace. Everyone, including Sharon, knows that we are now establishing a fundamentalist, radical, jihad Islamic and Hamas fundamentalist Muslim state on the Mediterranean coast. And I really don't think that after the deep disappointment that we had from Oslo Accords, that people here naive. They are not naive. They just think that Ariel Sharon had something that you cannot do. He took the majority of the left wing and the Arab members of the Knesset and took with him 10 seats from his own party and gave them this political victory. It's a temporary victory. We are going to bring him down very, very much, and I believe so soon as possible. And we are going to have our state not just to fight for our very survival. We really believe that we are not strangers here, and we fight also for our very revival.
Benny Alon, we hear it, and we thank you for joining us there from Gush Katif at the settlement in Gaza. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Benny Alon, member of Israel's Knesset, former cabinet minister of Ariel Sharon, Shai Feldman, listening along with me in the studio here stateside. Is that the voice of resistance in the Gaza Strip? Is that the analysis that you hear coming that says we shouldn't go? And what's more, we're not finished fighting about this. We're not giving up.
Well, I think that Benny Alon reflects much of the thinking among those who resist the disengagement. I hope that he's correct and that he's also representative in the sense that you're not going to see violence or violent resistance. And he emphasized that the resistance will be confined to the rules of democratic game, and I hope that that will be remain the case for all the settlers there. I don't have complete confidence in that, but I hope that that's the case. There's also he is also correct in the sense that this step, strictly speaking, is not about peace. It is exactly about what you said in the beginning of the program. It's about restructuring the nature of Israel. It's about Israel's future as a state. And the need to restore it to being a Jewish and democratic state, and you cannot do that without disengaging the two communities. So the purpose really is to restore Israel's character, rather than strictly speaking achieving peace. At the same time, one also has to say that to the extent to which it would be possible to separate the two communities, it also means less friction between the two communities, and in the end, it will also have an effect on peace. But it is also correct that, strictly speaking, this particular step is not aimed at achieving peace.
If it should work well, it may ease the path toward peace. If it's
right.
If it's a mess, if the Palestinians have disorder, if there's continuing resistance or political upheaval in Israel, it could actually make that more difficult. I want to begin to turn to our callers, if we may, a lot of them waiting to join us. We'll hear more from Israel in a moment. But right now, Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Yes, the point that I want to make is that Sharon is not withdrawing for moral reasons. This is a military logistical withdrawal to basically circle the wagons. And the settlers in Gaza are going to do their best to make this the ugliest image possible. Settlements like Netzarim, it can be very ugly, and it's not going to happen again. This will just happen one time, and when the rockets start falling again in a couple of weeks after this, in Israel, it's the ball game is over, and
the ball game is over. Meaning, Alan, that you're saying that Sharon is doing this for strategic reasons, circling the wagons. That this is the last withdrawal. You don't expect more in the West Bank, let's say.
No, I don't. I expect the wall to be completed in short order and circling the wagons, because Saudi Arabia will never recognize Israel's right to resist, and money will keep pouring in for the eventual destruction of Israel, and that's the end game for Hamas and others like that.
So do you welcome the Gaza withdrawal or not, Alan?
From a strategic standpoint, if I were Sharon, I would do the same thing. From a moral standpoint, I think Jews should be allowed to live in Arab countries as they had prior to the foundation of Israel and pay taxes and be respected for their rights, but it's not possible. There will be pogroms and mass murder if they live anywhere in Arab country now. So now it can't be done.
There's the ambivalence right there. Alan, we've got it. We thank you very much for your call. I want to turn back to Israel now, to Jerusalem. We're joined there by Reuven Hazan. He's professor of political science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Mr. Hazan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So here is, we're hearing both from Benny Alon in Gaza today and from our caller just now saying this isn't moral, it's strategic. Benny Alon doesn't agree with the strategy. The caller may. How do you see what's unfolding here? Is this a move toward accommodation with the Palestinians? Is it a move to redefine or define Israel itself?
Well, both should not be divorced or surgically separated. I think we can try to achieve both if we remain optimistic. But I must agree with my colleague in the studio, with Shai, that I don't think what we're talking about here is peace. And let's remember that while the disengagement today might be relatively coordinated with the Palestinians due largely to the fact that Yasser Arafat is no longer here, but disengagement was planned and conceived as a tactic by the Sharon administration for the simple reason that we did not have a partner, so we were going to do what is in Israel's own interests without even negotiating with our next-door neighbors. Disengagement was negotiated, if at all, with Washington and not with anyone in the Palestinian Authority. This leads us to what Shai said, that Israel is doing this because it needs to, and Shai pointed out all of the good arguments, so I'm just going to say them telegraphically. Israel as a democracy is probably the most important of principles that we need to keep. A Jewish state, a Jewish homeland, is as important but not relevant for many of us if Israel ceases to be a democracy. If you looked at the front page of our best daily newspaper, which is Haaretz, just a couple of days ago, they announced that right now, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, the number of Jews had dipped for the first time below 50%.
This is if you include the Palestinian populations in the West Bank, in Gaza, and Arab population inside Israel.
Yes, if you add everything together, not just the Arab population in Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but also some problematic elements in Israeli society, such as immigrants and foreign workers, you reach 49.4% who are Jews, as opposed to 50.6%. In other words, the borders that the Israeli army patrols today include more non-Jews than Jews.
And this is the challenge to the notion of Israel as a Jewish state, as a democracy, you're saying?
Yes. Israel can be a Jewish state, clearly, for the foreseeable future, without giving any of the minorities inside it the ability to vote. The task is to achieve both, for Israel to be a Jewish and a democratic state simultaneously. And in order to do that, Israel is today on the brink of approximately one-half of the people who inhabit the area that its army patrols not being able to participate fully in the democratic process. Now, if you go back 57 years to the creation of the state, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that we will be a Jewish and democratic state. It would be a pity if 57 years late we had to rewrite that Declaration of Independence and decide if we're going to be a Jewish or a democratic state. What Ariel Sharon is doing is trying to keep the Declaration as is and keep Israel based on the two most essential principles which make it what it is today.
Shai Feldman, we see voices from Israel saying that this move in Gaza will buy Israel 20 years demographically, 20 years during which, if you peel off Gaza, there will still be, this is kind of a high concept definition, but there will still be a Jewish majority between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. So is there a fundamental change here, or is there just a buying of time with the Gaza pullout?
Well, this is the reason, a very important reason, why I believe that the concept of Gaza first and last is a fallacy. There is no real option of freezing the situation post this disengagement plan. And the limited disengagement in the northern part of the West Bank, in my view, is an indication that Ariel Sharon himself does not believe. For otherwise, why throw this bone, which is this limited engagement in the West Bank, if you don't really have an intention of continuing the process in the West Bank? And my view is that you're absolutely correct, that you buy time, you buy limited time, but the demographic consideration, the demographic factor, the demographic locomotive, if you wish, for moving Israel in this direction would exist even after this disengagement plan. Because Israel, in the end of the day, has to disassociate itself from the large population, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank, and also, by the way, in some of the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, which is, of course, an even more contentious issue.
Right. Reuven Hazan, we heard Benny Alon, a former Sharon cabinet member, saying earlier, this won't stand, that Sharon will be tossed out politically, and this new direction will be reversed. What do you think of that?
Well, I must object to almost everything that Benny Alon said, except what Shai already pointed out were the positive elements that hopefully we will not see violence. But when Benny Alon says that everyone in Israel, and I quote him, sees this in a very clear way, then either he lives in an Israel that I do not live in, or every public opinion poll in the last 6 months shows that his definition of everyone should be changed with a minority. There are no more than one-third of Israelis who constantly and persistently have wanted to stay in Gaza, despite a terrific and extremely well-run public relations campaign. When Alon says that Sharon took the majority from the left, I'm sorry, but when I read the election results and the numbers in the Knesset today, I don't see where he took this majority from. The Sharon locomotive, to use Shai's word,
yes,
The Likud party has 40 seats. If you add to this the 15 seats of a pro-disengagement party called Shinui, that's already close to half of the parliament. I'm not including the Labor Party.
So he looks secure to you. Reuven Azam, we've got to take a short break here. Shai Feldman, please stand by. Listeners, we're talking about the Gaza pullout and Israel's identity. You can join us. Are your hopes raised or lost with the pullout? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gaza pullout and Israel's identity. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does the essence of Israel change with this concession, with this withdrawal? Is this the loss of an ideal or a step toward realism? Maybe, even, someday, peace. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined this hour from Jerusalem by Reuven Hazan, Professor of Political Science at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. With me in the studio, Shai Feldman, Director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. And right now on the phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Kareem joins us. Hello, Kareem, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for having my call. I just wanted to just talk a little bit about the basic injustice and the spin that the whole debate seems to be coming from. For instance, we're having a talk about the pullout from Gaza, and no Arab guests, unless you have another show planned.
We do indeed. As I said at the top of the hour, we will be talking with Palestinians about how they intend to act on what's happened here. But this morning we do have a narrower focus, and deliberately. But what do you think, Kareem?
Well, then let's talk about that. That's fine with me. I think the word democracy is definitely overused. One can still have an apartheid state and system with a democracy if the democracy is reserved for an ethnic and religious exclusive majority or minority, depending on how it is.
But don't
South Africa under the Afrikaners was a democracy. The U.S., when we were denying black people the right to vote and so on, we were a so-called democracy.
But Kareem, let me ask you, in that case, do you take heart from the perspective we're hearing here this morning, Shai Feldman, Reuven Hazan, saying Israel can't really be a democracy if it doesn't deal with the demography, with the whole population of what's there along the Mediterranean?
Well, I don't know how they would. I don't know how their vision of reconciling the Judaism of the country along with a real democracy in the sense of.
Well, part of it is by getting Israelis and Israelis' troops out of Gaza, and as Shai Feldman suggests, at some point out of much of the West Bank.
Okay, and that would be a start. But there's also this apartheid system also is very present in 48 borders. Many Arab villages, which don't show up on Israeli maps, are taxed at the same rate that Israelis are, but do not receive anywhere near the same services. The apartheid system and ethic is throughout the whole historic stolen Palestine.
Even with the formal boundaries of Israel, you would charge. Let us pick that up. Reuven Hazan, what do you say to that?
Well, I must respectfully and completely disagree with your most recent caller, because on the one hand, you cannot have an apartheid system and a democracy. One precludes the other.
The caller says South Africa pretended to.
South Africa was not a democracy. There is no book that I teach on democracies that allows that form of regime to be called a democracy. And if we're going to believe simply to what politicians say to the media, then we can throw political science out the window.
Got it.
But also, on top of that, if you notice the last sentence that sort of slipped out from your recent caller, who said that the apartheid problem was a problem in all of stolen Palestine. Mm. In other words, he also said before that the West Bank and Gaza Strip, if there's a withdrawal from the West Bank as well, that would be a good start. In other words, this is someone who obviously doesn't truly believe that the state of Israel as a Jewish state has the right to exist. What we have is a difference on principles here, and therefore to talk about the logistics of implementing something today is a moot issue with such a person. I want to throw in one more thing into this pot before you're going to have to move on from here. There is something that comes after disengagement. Let us keep our fingers crossed that disengagement happens, it happens without too much violence, and that by the end of this month, most Israelis and Israeli troops are out of Gaza. From that moment on, we have to wait and see what the Palestinians are capable of doing in Gaza. Because Israel is a democracy, and the Israeli government does function and is elected based on public opinion. If Mr. Netanyahu, who resigned a couple of days ago, is right, if Gaza is going to become a terrorist base, public opinion in Israel will swing against making further similar concessions on the West Bank. So on the Palestinian side, let me put it in a very simplistic way, we've thrown the hot potato at them. The ball is in their court. If Gaza is calm, public opinion in Israel, as it did in southern Lebanon, as it is doing now in Gaza, will push the government before the 20 years that we have as a window of demographic opportunity comes to an end. The public opinion here will push the government to get out of most of the West Bank. If, on the other hand, Netanyahu can lead the charge, dethrone Sharon, win the next elections, and follow a hardline attitude that anything we give to the Palestinians makes the life of every Israeli everywhere in Israel unsafe and unstable, then we really have to decouple between what Israel is doing now in the Gaza Strip and any possible hopes of accommodation with the Palestinians.
So a chance here, but a long, long way from any guarantee. Reuven Hazan, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us from Jerusalem. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Shai Feldman, you see the exchange here, what's described as being on the line. If there's some semblance of peaceful order after this, that Israeli public opinion that's supporting Ariel Sharon with this pullout may be open to further withdrawal. But there's no guarantee of that. Is it going to be a tremendously fragile way toward the further disengagement you envision if we've got rockets coming in from Gaza?
Well, it's going to be a complicated story. There's no question about that. Number one, this is an effort precisely to avoid becoming an apartheid regime. So that has to be absolutely and crystal clear as far as Israel is concerned. The second point about this is that we have to understand that any arguments that basically says, well, this is not really significant, and even if this was done through the entire West Bank, it's not significant either, because until you deal with the Arab citizens of Israel, we haven't solved any problem. That, of course, feeds, and there are voices like that on the Palestinian side, that, of course, feeds into the Israeli extreme right, because basically what the extreme right says, this is a slippery slope,
give an inch,
and the
take
other,
a mile.
And the other side will not stop until Israel is destroyed. In other words, when he said every stolen land, which includes everything that Israel conquered in the 1948 war, is up for grabs as far as the Palestinians are concerned, this is interpreted by the right as ammunition for their argument. It says, you're not really achieving anything because the other side won't stop until Israel is destroyed. So we have to understand these debates feed into each other. Arab extremism feeds into Israeli extremism and vice versa. The third point about this is we have to understand continuing this process in the West Bank inevitably is going to be much more difficult than the story in Gaza for at least two reasons. One is the historical linkage to the West Bank as far as Jewish history is concerned
much
is
deeper,
much,
biblical.
Much deeper. Secondly, Gaza has defined borders and is completely fenced so that once Israel withdraws from Gaza, that disengagement will have a finite character to it. The situation in the West Bank is much more murky and therefore will require much more coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And here is where the performance of the Palestinians, not so much in terms of are they going to peace or not, but are they, in terms of their institution building, mm-hmm. are they becoming a unitary actor? Are they becoming an address? Is there somebody there that you can essentially hand over the territory to? Becomes a bigger and bigger question.
And a major issue still there as Hamas and the Palestinian Authority jockey for influence in Gaza. We'll see what happens in the coming days. Let's get another call. Jane is calling from Ontario, Canada. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. May I say I think the pulling out is excellent. I'd like to make an historical analogy. I hope it won't be offensive, but I think it's accurate. In 1939 to 40, the Germans went into France, Belgium, Holland, and we all spent the next 4 to 5 years throwing them out. In 67, we won't bother with 48. In 67, the Israelis went in to the West Bank and Gaza, and for, 38 years, they've still been there.
Of course, what happened between 1939 and 1945 is no small part of the reason that Israel came to be.
Yes, I know, but the point is that everybody said what the Germans did was totally against international justice. But for 38 years, the Israeli gentleman just said it was murky on the West Bank. Well, it isn't murky to the people watching that Berlin Wall go up. I really think that if you're going to discuss this, you have to discuss this from the point of view that for 38 years, the Israelis had absolutely no right to be where they are, and everybody should have told them that.
Jane, we've got it. We understand the perspective loud and clear. Thank you for calling. Shai Feldman, here is, of course, world opinion has long been very divided on this, but Israel has made its own way in spite of that. What do you think is pushing it? Just demographics? Has world opinion mattered here? Has Palestinian terror mattered here?
Yes, but all of these things matter. The fact of the matter is that this particular phase in this process is really driven by an effort to restore Israel's character as a Jewish and democratic state. Contrary to a previous caller, this is not about circling the wagons. It's not about security. Israel's security problem is much more acute in the West Bank than it was in Gaza. In fact, hardly any suicide bomber entered Israel from Gaza, because actually Gaza during this entire conflict was very well fenced,
locked
and very
down.
Well defended against. So this is really not about security. This is mostly about restoring. This is about demography and the effects of demography on Israel's character as a Jewish and democratic state. I don't want to get into an ideological argument with your last caller, but only to say one thing. Anybody who suggests analogies between Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and what the Germans did between 39 and 45 is again playing right into the extremist right-wing opponents of this process, basically by saying this is all these forces that are lined up against Israel are basically simply another expressions of anti-Semitism and so on and so forth. So I would say this is an extremely counterproductive line to pursue.
Shai Feldman, we've just got another minute. As you watch what's going on in Israel today, as you anticipate what's coming, are you optimistic about where this is headed? Is the public attitude in Israel shifting in a way that's going to make a more practical relationship between Israel and the Palestinians possible?
I'm optimistic in the long range because I think that one more precedent has been established with this move, and because I also believe that the demographic locomotive will continue to push Israel to disassociate itself from controlling large numbers of Palestinians. I'm not so optimistic in the short range because I think that, first of all, I don't see yet conclusive evidence that the Palestinians are building the institutions that would allow an easy way of continuing this process. And I think that the process in the short range is going to also fall victim to the electoral processes, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. Both sides are going to elections that will encourage grandstanding and so on and so forth. So I don't see in the short term that this will continue in the next few months, but I do see that after the electoral processes are over, both on the Israeli and Palestinian side, by mid-06, we will essentially continue the process.
Well, in the days ahead, we'll be checking in on the Palestinian side of this equation. It's been a fascinating look into the Israeli side today. Shai Feldman, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Shai Feldman, director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University, former head of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. In a moment, deadline day for Iraq's draft constitution. deadline is approaching for a new Iraqi constitution. Iraqi lawmakers said they would be able to meet tonight's midnight deadline, but crucial sticking points remain, including the role of Islam, the rights of women, and the distribution of power among Sunni, Shia, and Kurds. There is strong U.S. pressure to keep to the timetable. Chris Albritton is a correspondent for Time magazine. He joins me now from Baghdad. Chris, can you give us the latest? What time is it there? How close are we to the deadline? Does it look like they're going to make it?
Hard to say. It really is coming down to the wire. We've got any number of stories going back and forth that there might be a delay, there might not be a delay. If there is a delay, the Iraqi parliament will have to amend the transitional administrative law, which will need to be done in order to accept that delay. The draft has to be submitted to the parliament today, and then the parliament will debate it, and it has to be approved after that. But midnight tonight is apparently the deadline.
Chris, Washington is clearly taking this deadline very seriously. They want it there, and they want it politically back in the United States. Is the 71-member Constitution Drafting Committee also taking this deadline very seriously? Does it seem to really matter to them?
Well, they would prefer to be on their own timeline, to be frank. I've talked to several members of the committee, and there's a great deal of resentment towards the United States for moving on their timeline for what they see as American domestic political timelines. They would have liked more time, there's no doubt about that. But the U.S. has been putting an enormous amount of pressure through the embassy and through aid, U.S. Aid functions and things like that to get this thing done. So, yeah, they're taking it seriously because there's a lot of pressure coming on them from the Americans.
And we've heard...
If they'd had their way, it would have been...
Sorry, Chris, I know we've got a bit of a delay in the line here. We've heard, of course, some pretty strident statements by all of these parties about what they might do, what they want. Is it possible that this will end up in a meltdown, in a failure to achieve a constitution, or is it framed in such a way that one way or another they're going to come out with a draft document?
I think they're going to come out with a draft document. How good the document will be open to, we'll have to see. I think they're going to kick down the road a number of hard issues, such as the status of Kirkuk, women's rights, Islam, the role of federalism. Apparently, there's been some stories that the meeting tonight, the National Assembly meeting, was delayed for 2 hours to allow for a bit more talk on the Constitution to iron out, issues such as federalism right now. I don't know that they'll be able to come to an agreement before midnight tonight, and they may just say, well, we'll put it off and make sure this thing is easily amended so that we can fix it later. A similar dynamic was in play when the American Constitution was being written on the issue of slavery. They deadlocked on it. They came to a very poor compromise, and they kicked it down the road.
Exactly. We know what ended up there. Chris Albrighton, thanks for joining us on A Tough Line from Baghdad. We're grateful to you for being here. Chris Albrighton, correspondent for Time magazine. They're talking about a constitution that may kick down the road Islam, federalism, and women's rights. That's a lot to kick down the road. We will keep watching that subject in the days ahead. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.